Hi, Ann.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Welcome to Blogging Heads TV.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. We feel fortunate to have you. You're author of the highly esteemed and aptly named blog Alt House.
And
for those, a lot of our viewers are familiar with you. For those who aren't, would you like to kind of shorten their orientation period by stereotyping yourself with some sort of short label,
okay,
like conservative libertarian or something?
Well, I usually don't like those labels. I was on open source radio a few weeks ago, and I got called a libertarian. I said, you know, I'm not a libertarian. And the response I got was, well, I called you a libertarian last time you were on, and you didn't say anything. So now I realize if I get called something, I need to, you know, stop that right away. But to put it short, I consider myself a moderate. I consider myself sort of not partisan and not very political. I've never been involved actively in politics, but I like writing about politics. But my blogging is really from the perspective of someone who's able to talk about politics, interested in talking about politics without really having a strong dedication to one party or the other. For a long time, I voted for Democrats, but I did vote for Bush in the last election. So I get called a conservative. I think voting for Bush tends to cause people to call you a conservative.
Yeah, well, also, guest blogging for Glenn Reynolds on Instapundit could lead people to reach a conclusion like that if you weren't careful, probably.
Well, you know, I think an interesting thing in blogging is the way people link to you. I think I say a lot of liberal things, but liberals don't link to me. And if you say something that I think there's sort of a pattern among bloggers that at least I've noticed, and I've written about this, that the liberals kind of shun you if you don't toe the party line across the board, but the conservatives sort of ignore you when you don't agree with them, and then they wait for you to say something that they like, and then you link to them. So I'll get National Review links and things like that, links from, you know, right-wingers, because I think that they sort of, it's sort of like the looking for converts versus looking for heretics comment.
That liberals look for heretics and conservatives for converts, and in fact, we will talk a little about Joe Lieberman later, speaking of that.
Exactly, yeah. And that, as a blogger, that's really been my experience. I should throw in there that I am a law professor at the University of Wisconsin.
You are indeed. and I would think, I had wondered, I guess now that you're not letting me call you a conservative, I'm not wondering this, but I was thinking that someone of any kind of conservative inclination might be a little lonely in Madison, Wisconsin, at least to judge by stereotypes of Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, I guess I'm kind of a contrarian, and I think I'm sort of happy being different. I'm sure if I was in a conservative place, I'd be the lefty, you know. So it's just sort of my nature. Virtually everyone I know is either liberal or on the left, and I'm perfectly happy here. And I kind of think it's a nice jumping-off point for running a blog that I'm in a place that we're, you know, fish out of water or whatever. I like it.
Well, it's worked for you. You know, one thing I learned from reading your blog is that if you Google just the word Ann, your first name, you will appear on the first page of results. So you're one of, like, the primo Anns in the universe.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
I mean, you know, if you Googled Bob, you know, God knows. I mean, how many pages you'd have to leaf through before you saw me.
And I always thought Ann was such a boring and nothing name.
Yeah, well, I don't want to burst your bubble, but I would point out that there are some Anns who spell it A-N-N-E.
Yeah, I know. And I know Bobs.
If there were B-O-B-B Bobs, then that would move me up in the rankings a little.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry, but I
don't mean to. Look, you're feeling good about yourself. I don't want to lower your self-esteem. I'm sorry. That was the reptilian core in my brain that did that. Okay, so you're here at Wisconsin, and the first thing we're going to talk about actually is a story emanating from the University of Wisconsin.
Yes.
I mean, I want to put this as delicately as possible, but apparently one of your colleagues is a complete crackpot. Is that right?
Well, you know, he's a part-time adjunct hired to teach in the fall in a course called Islam, Religion, and Culture in a small department called Languages and Cultures of Asia. So I'm over here in the law school, and there is a department somewhere in this huge university called Languages and Cultures of Asia, and there is a course called Islam, Religion, and Culture, and they have hired a guy named Kevin Barrett to teach part-time in the fall. But he is a conspiracy theorist. He thinks that the U.S. government did the 9/11 attacks, and he's sure of it, too.
He's sure of it. That's what struck me. I read the article, and so far as I could tell, his evidence was He asserts, first of all, and this part could be true, that there were plans for an invasion of Iraq. I mean, he said that they were in concrete or something before 9/11, mm-hmm. and that 9/11 was, of course, the facilitator of the invasion itself.
Yes.
Now, even if you accept those two premises, neither of which is crazy, seems to me kind of a long way from there to being sure that the government perpetrated 9/11. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at the way we actually did go to war in Iraq, it didn't seem like they needed extreme evidence in order to do it. So why they would concoct this elaborate evidence to do it, it seems to me that when they wanted to do it, they kind of just did it without all that much evidence. So
well,
why would they have also gone to all this trouble to create the evidence?
They did try to whip up. I mean, I think it was easier for them to reach the threshold of public support that you really mm-hmm. kind of need. But I think it would have been a lot hard. I think it would have been very hard pre-9/11. I'll give him that much.
Yeah, I guess people were primed to be willing to do extreme things, and it didn't take that much to push them the rest of the way off the edge. But 9/11 was needed to make everybody completely different and soften us up for all of this.
I mean, does he have more evidence than that, or do we know?
Yeah, well, there's a website that's, I think, called Loose Change. There was a video that was made that was influential. And I think that there's something about conspiracy logic that once you get it going, it builds on itself, and people come up with all kinds of ideas, and they get each other going, and it works as a kind of a system. I mean, I was writing the other day about things that they could do here at the university in response to Kevin Barrett, because they don't want to fire him for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it would be interesting to have some kind of a public presentation about how, you know, conspiracy thinking works. Obviously, there's a big phenomenon of conspiracy thinking.
Yeah.
Going on it. And what makes, you know, intelligent, seemingly normal people do that? And it can't be that everybody's crazy. There must be something very seductive about and exciting about thinking in those terms compared to dull, ordinary life.
I think you should have a conversation with Kevin Barrett, and we should put it on Blogging Heads TV. That would give us insight into the mind of a conspiracy theorist. We'll send him the camera.
And do whatever else
is necessary.
He likes the publicity. He's been getting a lot of offers to be on a lot of... he's been on O'Reilly Factor and Hannity and Combs. You know, they've really taken an interest in him.
I'm sure they like to cast him as a typical liberal. But anyway, you think he should be allowed to teach, right? And this is not an issue of academic freedom in the classic sense, because this is not something he's saying he will take into the classroom, right?
Yes, he is taking.
Oh, he is taking it in the classroom.
I mean, a big part of the problem is that this is an introductory course on Islam, and he's making a week of the course be about how the U.S. government perpetrated the 9/11 attacks. I mean, it's Islam culture, not just religion. Religion and culture. So you could say that part of the subject really ought to be how maybe in various parts of the world Muslims believe certain things that we would view as being completely wrong, like that the government perpetrated the 9/11 attacks. But so it could kind of fit into the culture. You know, why do people believe what they believe? Why do people, get seduced into thinking that something is true that isn't true? Except
his answer would be because they're right.
Right, he thinks that they're right, isn't it? So I think that there's a problem with teaching the culture of Islam, with this idea being that there's a tendency to believe ideas, you know, because they're not getting a full, debate about what's really going on in the world, that they're getting a filtered news report, so they're believing things and the problems and, you know, that whole phenomenon. But the point is that they're actually right, and the U.S. government really is profoundly evil, and they figured it out, and that's the culture. They're right. Just a strange thing to teach from the perspective. It'd be one thing to teach that some people believe it, but it's another thing, I think, when the teacher actually believes it, something totally outlandish.
But you still you are not among the people who think he should be fired, or it's only a one-year contract, but the state legislature, most of the state legislators want him fired. But
yeah, and even Governor Doyle, who's running for re-election, he's a Democrat, he's saying that he would have reached a different decision. So there's some people, I would put myself in this group along with Governor Doyle, who think, maybe the decision should have been made the other way, but the provost here, Patrick Farrell, examined it and analyzed it, and I feel a tendency to want to defer to him, that he's made the best judgment, given that this guy's already been hired, to let him serve out his contract, it's just for one semester, that's really the best way to deal with it. Yeah. Now, I also keep saying, I think the big thing is, well, why was he hired in the first place? Isn't this symptomatic of some larger problem that people who believe things that are just completely unsound are getting hired to teach at the university. And so I think it's a distraction to get into the issue of firing him. If he were fired, he'd become a martyr. It would kind of catapult him into an even better position. And so, you know, what are you going to do once you've already made the decision to hire him? You've already got a problem that's beyond what you should have gotten into.
Yeah. It's easy in a way, conspiracy theory, getting back to what it is that makes people believe conspiracy theories, in a way it's an extension of kind of some features of normal human cognition. I mean, we all, once we have a theory, first of all, we're more receptive to evidence supporting it than evidence debunking it. We like to divide the world in between into friends and enemies. We tend to be suspicious of the people we're defining as enemies. And we like to associate with people who share our beliefs. And if the belief you're sharing is that is the theory, you know, and the internet really facilitates this. You can take a theory that will have relatively few adherents, but they can get linked up via the internet. Whereas they, you know, there wouldn't be enough of them in any one town to get together, but and there they are, they're in their own little world. You know, in the email when you called attention to this, you connected it to this other story of the doctoring of the photo. There was this Lebanese photographer who this just broke yesterday, took a picture of Beirut after an Israeli bombing and doctored the photo to make it look more shrouded in smoke than it naturally was. And bloggers got onto this right away and unmasked the guy. Actually, if you look at the photo, it seems kind of evident to me that it had been doctored. The smoke was had unusual patterning in it. But the blog Little Green Footballs, which I think played a role in Rathergate or one of those other unmaskings. So you were kind of saying, well, conspiracies do happen. In other words, that people doctor things. But it seems to me that how rapidly that was unmasked, the photo doctoring, also illustrates that in the modern environment, there's a lot of kind of transparency. There's sufficient transparency for me to think that actually it may be that conspiracies are more likely than ever to get uncovered. Because, you know, more and more of what people do is documented. There's a paper trail or an electron trail. The blogosphere is very good at latching on to these things and digging for the evidence. In fact, that's what these conspiracy theorists are themselves doing. It's just that they're kind of hard to discourage.
I mean, I think that the theory can spread, but it can also play out much more quickly, and people can, and then a lot of people are pulled into the effort of finding out what's wrong with the theory.
Right.
I mean, I'm a little worried. When I looked at that photograph problem, what I worried about was that, well, this is really crude, bad photoshopping.
Yeah.
But obviously, some people are really good at it. Why should I believe any picture? Why should I believe anything anyone shows me? But that's a kind of a conspiracy framework. It's sort of like, well, the world is just a big scam, and I see a little loose ravels hanging, and, well, those are the obvious things, like that smoke in the photograph. But what about all the other things? The fact that there are any of those flaws just suggests that if I could really penetrate into it, there'd be flaws everywhere. And there's all kinds of schemes, and everyone in power is doing something to maintain their power, and you know, with much better Photoshop experts than that one thing that happened to get discovered.
Sounds like you and Kevin Barrett might get along, Ian. I don't know. You're moving in that direction. It's true, but it's also true that presumably there are tools that professionals can use to discern even fairly good Photoshop doctoring. I mean, I'm not sure, but if there are, then those tools being in the hands of a few people would be enough for, you know, given the power of the blogosphere, to probably unmask a lot of these things. But have you, so it's kind of an arms race, as a lot of things are. Have you talked to this guy, though?
No, I don't think I see him when he's on TV. You know, I set up Google alerts so that I can see whenever articles are written, and I often write about it. But no one ever communicates with me. I mean, he doesn't call me. He doesn't show up in my office. He doesn't email me. Neither does the administration. I mean, nobody talks to me about it. It's kind of funny that I'm here and I'm a law professor and I write about it all the time. And I know that people know that I'm writing about it. I assume they're reading it. But nobody communicates with me about it. It's really just, speaking of transparency, it's all just there online. And it's just a debate in public, which, you know, I think is basically good.
Yeah, well, if you run into them, we stand ready to broadcast your interrogation. It would be great TV. It would be great TV.
Well, he's an interesting character on TV. He gets very impassioned in a way that I think seems a little crazed, you know, that he's so passionate about his theory. You can see on his face that he feels like, well, I'm really doing well here. I'm really getting my theory out. And meanwhile, the people who are watching it are thinking, wow,
yeah,
this guy is really, you know, manic about that. That just doesn't look right.
That's what we would like to see on Blogging Heads TV, and if you can arrange it,
well,
that's entertainment. okay, well, from moving from one conspiracy theory to another, I mean, we were going to talk about Mel Gibson a little bit. He has a theory about people who are responsible for things, namely all of the wars ever. You, in your email to me, saw a connection between the, is Mel Gibson anti-Semitic question, and there is recently amassed evidence that he is, and the is Oprah gay question, right?
Yeah, my connection there, I've blogged about both of those things. The reason I put them together was because it seems to me that we're very, you know, we sort of live with our celebrities, they're important in our sort of psychic life, they're part of the culture, and we heroize them, or we think about what they're really like, or we, you know, it's not enough to just see the part of themselves that they decide to present to the world. We also want to know what they're really like inside. So with respect to Mel Gibson, I was concerned, you know, I like some of his movies. I never saw The Passion of the Christ, but that's obviously a really important movie to some people. And then to add to that, this idea that there's something in his head that's so offensive, you know, are you going to allow that to affect then, does that change all of his movies? Does that change your understanding of all of the work that he does? I mean, to me, it does. And then with respect to Oprah, it's sort of like, well, she's this person that she presents herself as on television, and you could either take that as the part of herself that she presents to the world, or you could put a lot of effort into trying to think, well, what's she really like? You know, what are they really like? You know, the classic question about a celebrity. To me, I think someone's sexual orientation or whatever they do sexually, if they don't want to talk about it, I shouldn't be thinking about it, and yet, but obviously it is tempting to think about what someone's private sexual life is like. I don't think it has that much to do with the sort of ideas they present to the world, so I don't think it's like Mel Gibson's situation in that way, but I think there's a similarity in that we have this psychic bond to celebrities, and we want to think about the aspects of them that they don't really want to present to us. We're very enticed by that. You can connect that back to the conspiracy theory stuff, too. It's like we want to know what is the secret side of this world that we get to
know. Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it's kind of none of our business if somebody's gay unless they want to talk about it. Which, I mean, naturally people will speculate about celebrity. I mean, I do think that's different from the Mel Gibson case. You would probably agree, right, that, I mean, first of all, you have libertarian tendencies, right? You would admit to that, right? You have some identification with libertarian logic or not?
Yeah, on things like individual freedom, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I don't have any ideas about economics on this.
Okay, side. Okay, but on the in terms of freedom speech, but nonetheless,
yeah.
Would you agree that we should, especially in a multi-ethnic society, we should sanction with I'm not talking about legal sanction, but moral sanction, social sanction, we should sanction expressions of bigotry, of ethnic bigotry. In other words, you know, when people who express bigotry no longer get invited to parties, it may even affect their work. That's okay with you? I mean, it's okay with me. It seems to me that's the way for a multi-ethnic society to function.
I mean, I think part of free speech values is, you know, more speech. So I think expressing the disapproval, I think letting people know that you think it's evil to think that,
yeah.
I think that's part of the expression. So I don't see that as anti-libertarian. I think a lot of times people get it wrong, and they sort of act like to care about free speech is to let everybody say anything and not, you know, not express disapproval as if by saying that they're bad or wrong is forcing them to shut up, or it's the government censoring them.
Right. Now, my view is the way to keep the government from censoring things is to have a robust system of moral sanction, you know, informal sanction.
Yeah, and it's really lame if people think that freedom has to do with not expressing any kinds of values.
I know. They get that mixed up all the time. You get accused of censorship if you disapprove of anything in the world.
Yeah.
He's not the classic case. I mean, in other words, he's not someone who was out there intentionally expressing bigotry day after day after day. He's somebody who had this feeling within him, and it came out because he got drunk. And that that is a different case.
Right. He at least knows it's wrong. He knows it's in his interest to hold it back. And then with the inhibitions released when he's drunk and he's also very angry and not thinking straight, then it comes out. I mean, we were having a big debate on my blog about whether, you know, in vino veritas, if you say something when you're drunk, does that mean that you think it at all? And I kept taking the position, I think it means that you think it. It means that you knew enough to hold it back when you weren't drunk, but that it came out. It didn't just come, it's not just some random thought that isn't yours. It's obviously part of your head. And to me, that affects, you know, I think it, and it really resonates with the problem that people had with Passion of the Christ, that they thought they saw anti-Semitism. And a lot of people defended him and explained it away. But I think, you know, the synergy of putting the two things together, if he said things like that, and he also made a movie that looked like it had an anti-Semitic depiction, you know, that's very strong, those two things together. He should have been especially careful. If it was just a random thought that he didn't believe, he should have been especially, you know, suppressing of that thought.
Yeah.
Which maybe he was.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably true that most people, if you got them drunk enough, would say something quite socially unacceptable. Might well be a form of bigotry, might be a form of ethnic bigotry, might be, I mean, he apparently made crude comments about the anatomy of a female police officer.
Right.
Might be that.
Right.
On the other hand, you're the one responsible for the fact that you got drunk. Nobody held a gun on me.
Also, what is it, there's something that you let out, and you could say, well, you let it out because you were drunk, but you let it out. It had to be in there for you to let it out. So,
well, it did, but I guess what I'm suggesting is that there's more in the way of dark thoughts in more heads than we realize that would come out under certain circumstances.
Right.
And in fact, you know, generically speaking, one thing that allows human society to function as well as it does is that people don't say everything that's on their mind. And in some cases, they're not fully aware of some of what's kind of floating around.
But when someone's an artist, I mean, one thing that an artist does is kind of open up some of those channels, and maybe by writing about a character, they let some of that out, or they put it in a, you know, in a bad character or something like that, but it's still, you know, they might write about a murderer and they have angry feelings, but they don't actually commit murder. So, I mean, I think part of art is to let things like that flow out. And when you partake of someone else's art, when you watch some movie maker's movie, you know, you have a sense of, well, you care about what the author's intent is, or you try to grasp, but you can't always tell. But if the author goes out and says something like Jews are responsible for all the wars, I mean, that's going to become part of what goes into the mix when you think about what the art means.
Yeah. No, invariably. And that will not be the most severe punishment he endures, I'm sure. I mean, I don't think it'll ever be as easy for him to work in that town as it was.
I just feel like he really ruined his career in a way that's just worse than anything I've seen anyone else do. I mean, maybe some of the things.
Well, there was a CBS sportscaster, and I get two of them mixed up, so I won't mention either name. But he said something racist, and it turned out, and he said it on the air, and it turned out he had a drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of a, in those cases, I'm willing, when it's something that that drunkenness brings out, I guess I'm willing to let them, to give them kind of a lesser sentence, but not willing to acquit them in a certain sense. I mean, if you compare Mel Gibson to somebody who's like, you know, getting on the radio, making a point, you know, intentionally of conveying bigotry everywhere. I guess I would give them, you know, if we're handing out these informal kind of social sanctions, maybe they should get a stiffer sentence. Although you could also argue, look, he was doing it more subtly and effectively through his movies, and we now know. And so he should, you know, I don't know.
It radically affects how the movies work, right? Because he was doing it subtly before, and there was still a question, there was ambiguity. But then if he reveals this about himself, even though he didn't mean to, that then puts a gloss on the movie that wasn't there before. It really changes the movie. I mean, I'm not saying he should be legally punished, but I think he's really punished by the fact, by himself, by the fact that
he
changed the interpretation of his own best work.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, his reputation is permanently damaged, and I'm sure he'll find it harder to work, to gather resources for projects and things,
I think it's important to distinguish between, like, different kinds of racist comments. I mean, there's the kind where you just say something and it's sort of just a standard stereotype or an epithet and it slips out, and maybe you think you're making a joke but it doesn't come across as a joke. But when you say something like Jews are responsible for all the wars, I mean, that's a more complete thought. That's not just like Jesse Jackson said Hymie Town or something like that. I mean, it's a more complex thought that just contains a larger belief than just these sort of stray epithets.
Yeah.
So I think it means something more than just, for example, what he said to the female police officer. I just think that's almost nothing. I mean, it's rude.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
I actually don't know what that was, and I guess if you know, I won't ask you to repeat it right now.
It was a reference to her anatomy.
What's that?
It was just a reference to her physical anatomy. He called her as if she were the part of her anatomy that he was naming.
I think I'm getting the picture. I've narrowed it down to one or two anatomical features.
It's the above the waist.
Yeah. Well, speaking of females, we're just moving from one great transition to another here.
Okay.
Speaking of females, mm-hmm. you attended a conference called BlogHer, that's B-L-O-G, capital H-E-R,
right.
a conference,
yes.
I guess, for and about female bloggers.
Right.
And one question, I kind of looked at some of the stuff you wrote and other people wrote. One question is, do you accept the idea that, well, I guess I wouldn't go so far as to say that female blogging is a distinct genre, but would you say that there are some features of the blog, or some stylistic or thematic aspects of blogs, they're at least statistically correlated with gender? I mean, some things you're more likely to find in male blogs.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of overlapping bell curves or something like that, I think
that kind of thought. In other words, not a rigid stereotype, but are there any patterns at all?
I think probably similar to just the sex differences that you would observe in a lot of areas. I think maybe women bloggers are more likely to write about their feelings or write about their personal life, and men are more likely to write about politics and war and things like that. But that, you know, men do the women things that women are more likely to do, and women do the things men are more likely to do, so that it's a matter of overlap.
Yeah.
Do I really like having to relate to this whole issue and go to conferences where they specialize in talking about, you know, in bringing women together and kind of trying to heighten this phenomenon of how women are special or something like
that? And what's the answer to that question?
Well, I don't really like going to I don't really like going to conferences generally, but I was wary of the whole thing. I went because I was invited to be on a panel. I would not have gone, you know, like 700 women went.
How many women?
I would not have been 700.
And were they all bloggers?
Yeah. No, maybe some just were thinking of blogging. Maybe some were looking for commercial opportunities. A lot of people were handing out cards, and there were even some men.
So you must have been a real celebrity there.
Not really. No, I was just sneaking around. No, I don't know.
Your serotonin level went up, right?
No. Actually, not. I mean, I think Heather McDonald was more what was, and I think, I didn't really participate in very much of it, and I kind of avoided the hotel, and I was kind of off on my own.
Mm.
A problem that I had was that, you know, often when you get a group of women together, the women who will choose to gather together in that group are the women who see themselves as being fairly liberal or left. And then then there's a certain amount of disciplining or disapproval of women who won't go for the left position. And since I was invited to be on the political panel, and I was really invited to, you know, represent the conservatives, I really kind of felt a little, you know, threatened by the environment. So instead of having the feeling you were supposed to have, which is, oh, this is a big group hug, all the women are getting together to love each other, I sort of felt like, and I was being invited in particularly to be someone who would be at a disadvantage, or that would be, sort of a hated.
Yeah, you were exhibit A.
Now, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I wasn't eager to really be exposed like that. I mean, after I agreed to do it and I went there, I realized that I was kind of set up for an uncomfortable situation, so I wasn't really I wasn't really having the essential blogger experience. And, of course, I'm not the kind of person who would have sought out the essential blogger experience.
No, I take your point. That left-wing women are more likely to bond as women, I mean bond in a political sense, than right-of-center or centrist women are likely to bond
in a really
self-conscious kind of sisterhood way, right? I guess.
Right. And an issue that came up right away was, well, don't the male bloggers shun us, and why don't they link to us? And, you know, and I had to say, well, my experience is the male bloggers on the conservative side have been really good at linking to women and seem to go out of their way to do that. So I didn't have that problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of a sense of that sort of thing. There's a lot of just discipline that can go on within a women's group. You know, I could tell you a story that has something to do with you that would surprise
with me,
you.
With me personally?
It? Yep. You want to hear
it? Bring it on.
Well, many years ago, I was on a women's email, you know, back in the old days before blogs.
I remember those days, yes. I was 6 or 7 years old. I remember those days.
Yeah. Email lists. There was an email list of female women law professors that I was on. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but I was on we would talk about feminism, various women's issues, and your book, Moral Animal, came out. You remember
that? I remember
that
book, yes. That was 1994.
Yes. 94. Okay, so I was on a women's law professor's email list back when that book came out. I was reading about the book, and I did a post to the, a message to the list saying, framing some kind of a question. I have to dig it up in my old email to find out what it was, about your book. And I was met with a very snippy, immediate answer saying, we don't talk about that. And I responded to that saying, boy, that really made me feel bad. Talk about feelings. That made me feel bad that the subject was just ruled out of bounds for the list. You could at least told me nicely. And then the response to that was, well, everybody knows that sociobiology is, you know, beyond the pale with respect to what feminists care about. And, you know, you don't even talk about that here, or we even think you're a bad person for even bringing it up.
I'm familiar with that kind of feedback regarding that book. It's funny. I mean, times have changed. I mean, back then, it was considered much more radical to assert that there were any differences between the sexes that had any kind of basis in the genes. I mean, any behavioral or psychological differences than it is now. Even if you threw in all the to-be-sures, like these are just statistical differences, and human behavior is quite malleable, and it's all very dependent on the environment and blah, blah, blah. It was much more of a heresy to say that, and I got quite a bit of negative feedback. I wrote a piece with New Republic arguing that really feminism could never really be effective until it took into account some of the things that evolutionary psychology was seeming to substantiate with considerable firmness. I actually used the term evolutionary psychology and not the term sociobiology, which is a little more tainted, and which has been more associated, I would say, with simplistic depictions of human psychology. But anyway, that was not enough to save me. I was, Katha Pollitt was a big detractor of mine. We did some very entertaining debates, I've got to say. It was fun. She's you know, very smart and everything. But enough about me. where were we?
But the reason I brought up was because, you know, there's a certain way that groups of women act that's got a lot of really heavy-handed discipline. And I actually resigned from that email list after that because it really brought it home to me how much. How much freedom is suppressed in those groups, and I have a real aversion to being treated like that. I really hate it.
Yeah. I mean, most groups have their taboos, and there are taboos that may be socially healthy. My own view has actually been that there is a sharp distinction between talking about kind of gender differences and talking about ethnic differences. One distinction is that in Darwinian theory, there are very clear theoretical reasons to expect some gender differences, and the same isn't just not true of ethnicity. I mean, you can speculate, but it's a very elusive question empirically. The other question is just that relations among ethnic groups are more potentially volatile. I mean, there can be lots of arguments between men and women, but society is never going to break down into a literal war between men and women, because ultimately heterosexual men and women kind of need each other too much, in a sense. And
right, that's a big issue in feminism, is the idea that there's this horrible structural problem that you're sleeping with the enemy and you can't divide up the group. The fan finally went off. I'm sorry that the air conditioner came on. My sound is much better now. It's driving me crazy.
Oh, good.
But I should have turned the air conditioner all the way down, up, or whatever before starting this. So I apologize for that.
Oh, that's okay. We'll know next time. And if they can't hear anything you said at all, I will vouch for its fierce intelligence.
I was going to get up and go over and affect it, but then I thought, oh, you can't go off screen. Once your head is there, you got to be the blogging head.
No, actually, on Blogging Heads TV, you can do anything you want, believe me.
I could have gone over. Oh, yeah, I remember once Mickey dropped his keyboard and he went off camera for a
minute. Oh, yeah, no, they love that. They love all the differences between this and real TV.
Yeah, yeah, actually it could have been entertaining. I should have done it.
Absolutely. You can eat. But, you can eat if you want, whatever you want.
Yeah, I'm trying to create action by taking a drink.
You can drink alcohol.
Oh, you're not seeing this, obviously.
You can reach Mel Gibson levels of candor, if you would like.
Okay. But now I forgot what I was saying there. Something about the way groups of women, there's a certain kind of a theory within feminism that you
Sleeping with the enemy,
in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe that's the... actually, that is our next subject anyway. Men who won't marry, and the women who won't marry.
Good segue.
This has just been seamless transitions throughout.
Very good.
There was this New York Times article about men of relatively little education, men who hadn't finished college, in some cases high school, tending much more than ever not to have married by their late 30s or early 40s. I mean, it was something like 18% of men in their early 40s who hadn't finished college or something had never married. I may have that wrong, but we'll link to the article. And in any event, the number had risen quite dramatically in the last 25 years.
Here I have it. 18% of men ages 40 to 44 with less than 4 years of college have never married. That's up from 6% a quarter century ago. Among similar men ages 35 to 39, the proportion jumped to 22% from 8% in that time.
Right. Now, I mean, one thing that struck me is they kind of make it sound in the article as if these men are just less inclined to marry, whereas they always made it sound like the man's choice. It seems to me, I mean, they are less inclined to marry the women that are available to them. But it's possible that, given various things, the kind of women available to men in that category are just less likely to meet their specifications, the specifications of these men. I mean, you know, almost everyone could find someone to marry. You know, if the only question was, can you find a human being who will marry you, the answer is yes for pretty much anyone. Everyone is exercising some discretion. And it seems to me that part of this was kind of under. You saw bits of it in this piece, but to what extent, these men are basically having trouble attracting the kind of women they want to marry.
Well, I think that there are more men who are, or the sort of cultural message that you will get married that everybody used to just have, especially women, and then the economic reason that women would have to marry would cause them to lower their standards till they got to the point where they found someone to marry, and they would get to those men who are now just on the outs. Now you have more women who can have economic independence, so they don't need to marry for that reason, and then that just leaves them shunning these men who end up at the... You know, this is a real theme in the New York Times. They have an ongoing series about it. And, you know, you could really attack it as being anti-feminist, although I'm sure the New York Times doesn't want to be anti-feminist, I would assume.
You mean it,
but it seems like they have this ongoing theme that the women's movement has hurt men and that now it's time to feel sorry for the men. Although every time they write the article, they don't write it in the way that they write articles that invite you to feel sorry for women. They write it in a way that makes it seem like the men are really losers, and it's hurting them now. It didn't used to hurt them. It used to be able to be okay to be a loser because someone would have to marry you because of economic need. And now that women have gotten the benefits of the women's movement, these men are now being exposed for the losers that they are. That's my characterization of the New York Times.
Okay. Yeah, it could be. I haven't noticed that pattern. I guess I wouldn't. I mean, if they're focusing on the plight of males, I would kind of, you know, revel in that rather than have critical distance from it, being a male.
Well, it's a series, so if you go to that one article, you'll see in the sidebar the other articles.
Oh, I didn't realize that was part of the series.
They're calling attention to it as a series,
It's interesting. You know, we were talking about evolutionary psychology, and it used to be one prediction of critics of evolutionary psychology used to be that once women became financially, I mean, evolutionary psychology had posited that one thing that women find attractive in men is high status and access to resources like wealth. And there was an argument about why that was, if you look at our evolutionary history, and that it was maybe not ineradicable, but fairly firmly grounded in female tastes. And there, one test of this you know, people say, well, that's just because women are not financially secure themselves, and so they need these very affluent men. But this article is actually consistent with the story that is unfolded through studies, you know, empirically, that actually when women attain high levels of education and high vocational levels and high levels of income, their attractiveness, their attraction to men of high status and wealth is not at all undiminished. If anything, it's right. more pronounced, and these men are kind of suffering from that.
It's more pronounced because they don't need to lower their standards to get to the men who can economically support them. They can economically support themselves, but their, you know, built-in intuitive feeling of who they're attracted to remains the same. So it's not like, well, now that I don't need the money, I could just find an attractive man apart from money.
Right.
You know, I don't need the money, but I still only find the men attractive who are coming with this sort of
economic
support.
That seems to be the case. And, you know, it's possible, and I think I actually argued in the book we talked about, that, you know, the distribution of income among males can exacerbate this problem, because if women tend to be attracted to men with great resources and so on, and resources are very unevenly distributed, and one thing that's happened lately is they've become more unevenly distributed, you know, income inequality has grown, then it's going to be even harder for men at the bottom of the income spectrum to attract women, and what you actually see happening when you have a high divorce rate, we call it serial monogamy, but it's the functional equivalent of polygamy in a certain sense, which is that, you know, if you look at what, you know, rich men who go through a lot of wives, one thing that remains constant as the men get older is that the women remain relatively young, right? I mean, you know, the there are statistics on this. The first wife was 1 year younger than the man, the second wife is 5 years younger, and so on. And they keep focusing on women who are of or near reproductive age. So if you do the math in a situation like that, you know, rich men are ultimately, on average, monopolizing the kind of reproductive years of more than one woman per man.
Right.
There, and so if the men at the bottom of the spectrum would like to start a family, that's less available to them than it would be otherwise. And,
right,
and this
right.
is a this is a conservative family values case for a more equal distribution of income, in my view.
Right, yeah. I could see that coming. That's definitely true. And you could say that economic equality has to do with much more than economics. It has to do with how widespread just ordinary family happiness.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I was shocked to read in this article is that apparently in the current tax system, low-income men and women, if they're both wage earners, are actually penalized for getting married. Maybe that's common knowledge. I didn't realize that. That seems to me like about the most perverse incentive. I mean, I just can't believe. You would think there would be almost unanimity politically for changing that, right?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a conservative idea that if you don't want to, remove the incentive for the woman to stay home with the children. That
So if there's no disincentive.
So if you equalized it, then more women would make the choice to stay at work. But if you make the tax consequence severe if they both work, that makes the choice to stay home with the children more attractive, and more women will do that. So that's why conservatives.
Removing the disincentive for them to get married is to remove the incentive for the woman in the married couple to stay at home?
Right.
Is that intrinsic? I can't think it through at the moment if there's a way around that trade.
It's
apparently an intrinsic
trade-off.
Because
you could just have tax rates that had nothing to do with marriage and stop having any incentive about marriage. That would solve the problem. Everybody would just be single. But then they came up with this idea of the joint return, and that was designed to give a special break for people who formed those families. But then over time, as women started to work, that created a bad problem for the woman working. Why is she taxed so much? That's the marriage penalty. It wasn't deliberately adopted. But to get rid of it is hard to do because it changes the equation or the analysis how you weigh the cost and benefit of working when you're a couple. And so,
assuming the incentives are having effect, then the price conservatives are paying for their desire to incentivize the woman's, a married woman staying at home, is to also make it unattractive, is also incentivize unmarried motherhood, in effect, at lower income levels.
Well, you'd also have to give up a lot of tax revenue if you changed it. if you allowed married couples to file as two single people as opposed to the married filing separately. I don't know how it all got started, but the thing is, to get rid of the marriage penalty would give up a lot of revenue, so it's hard. That's hard to do. How would you make it up? You'd have to raise taxes somewhere else, and nobody ever wants to do that.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think a lot of people probably would be willing to live with a revenue shortfall if you can have it both ways, and I just don't have time to sit through and think through whether you could figure out a way to have it both ways. Or in other words, whether you could make the conservatives happy and not incentivize. Mm-hmm. It may be an intrinsic trade-off. Never mind. I definitely shouldn't.
There's a lot of money at stake, and it's very hard to change it. There's been talk about doing it for a long time, and a lot of people pay a lot of money for being married. I paid a lot of money when I was married. But, you know, it's really hard to change.
Yeah. I avoid thinking about the tax system.
Yeah, it's too boring.
It is boring, but every once in a while you realize it's consequential.
Yeah, it's kind of important.
Let's see. Now, we were any other thoughts on men who won't or can't marry?
Wait, I couldn't remember.
Yeah, just before we move on, do you have any other thoughts on the men who won't or can't marry subject?
No, you can go on to the next subject.
All right, and that is Joe Lieberman.
You want to talk about Lieberman? We got to talk
about
Lieberman.
Yeah, I don't have any breathtaking insights, but it seems like this week you must talk about that.
Yeah, well, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think he's going to win just because the Alan Schlesinger Republican candidate is so bad that the Republicans will just get the idea to vote?
Yeah, apparently the Schlesinger guy, one thing he's done is, like, gamble under an assumed name or something.
Yeah.
That's not your optimal Republican candidate. It's, at least Bill Bennett used his own name, I think, right?
I think that they didn't realize he had a bad past because he was using a fake name, you know, so that's obviously going to be used against him. But don't you? And then there's also a question of if Lieberman gets elected, which I think seems like he has a good chance, you know, what will it be like for him when he ends up back in Congress?
He says he's going to, you know, be a de facto, in effect, a Democrat. I mean, there's some quasi-formal thing he said that he would subscribe to, I forget what it is, in Congress that would amount to being a de facto Democrat. I don't know, and I don't know enough about the politics to know whether he can get reelected. You know, of course, the Republicans are spinning this as, this just proves the Democrats aren't serious about the war on terror. Some Democrats are complaining about that. I think, certainly it doesn't logically mean that. I mean, Lieberman was kind of a special case. I mean, like, for me, I don't think anyone would say that opposition to the war in Iraq, per se, was the problem. It was how stubborn he was in defending it, long past the point where it seemed, you know, plausible that it had been a good idea, and just little signs of devotion to George Bush. The thing that drove me crazy was his saying,
"The kiss."
Democrats should not, we are at war, and we should not question the credibility of our commander-in-chief. It seems to me, actually, maybe war, if you really believe you have evidence that your president is not trustworthy, war is maybe a better time than average to bring it to the attention of people. And certainly, in a war like this that, let's face it, is going to go on more or less forever. I mean, we're never going to end terrorism completely. The idea that it's unpatriotic to question the credibility of your president is, to me, such a pernicious thought.
But I think he said that back when, it was very shortly after Bush got reelected, and he was saying things like, look, he's going to be president for the next 3 years. We have to take the war seriously. To just oppose the president all the time when he is going to be president for the next 3 years is just too damaging to national interests. We have to be, you know, bipartisan. We have to try to work this out instead of trying to exploit everything that happens to make Bush look bad. We need to get together and try to do the best we can with the situation, given that he is going to be president for the next 3 years, you know, face reality and deal with that. People took that very
well. I should dig up the soundbite. Maybe what I read or saw was out of context. My impression was he was saying, "You should not question this president's credibility." What I saw, as I recall, he was not just saying we shouldn't criticize him all the time. It was specifically about questioning his credibility, not just criticizing him in any sense. And B, I thought he was fairly explicit in saying, or certainly quite direct in implying, you should not do this at all while we're at war. He's our commander-in-chief. Maybe I'm wrong. I guess now I'm obliged to actually do the homework and dig up the quote, and we'll link to it.
Well, you know, I don't think I don't think he's the greatest speaker. I think there's something very sort of windy and bland about the way he expresses himself, and he takes these ideas that are often put in terms of how we shouldn't be divisive and we need to work together, and they're just a sort of, you know, it's such padlong politically, and I can see why it enrages people. I mean, I think when he was running as vice president for vice president with Gore, that he didn't do a very good job. When, of course, when he was running on his own for president in 2004, that he didn't do a he's not really that good at expressing himself, and I don't think he stood up to the challenge of Lamont in the primary that well either. I mean, he's actually not that good of a campaigner.
No, and there's something kind of annoyingly, I don't know.
Whiny?
Well, and a little, what is it about him? He's a little, I mean, he's, the son, it's almost kind of like whatever age you are, it's like listening to your father talk to you when you're hearing Joe Lieberman.
Yeah. There's something a little annoying about that. You know, one thing that happened to me, back in 2000, I was completely for Gore in 2000, and I didn't even consider voting for Bush, except for the one time I considered thinking about, I considered voting for Bush was during the vice presidential debate, which I thought Lieberman would easily trounce Cheney, and then the two of them started talking, and I started feeling like, Cheney seems to be the better. He was making sense to me, and Lieberman was driving me nuts with his sort of just, you know, sort of oratorical old man kind of a style, and so I actually think there's some kind of a problem with his self-presentation that actually isn't very effective.
So now back to the subject of Ann Althouse. So you voted... You voted Democrat in 2000 and then for Bush in 2004, which is the reverse of the pattern. I among people who switched that I know, I mean, I know a number of conservatives who were fed up with Bush by 2004 and thought he was gonna ruin the world. And by my lights, he has proceeded to fulfill their expectations, but we won't get into that argument. But you're kind of unusual then, right?
Well, take into account, I also voted for Clinton twice. I voted for Mondale. I voted for McGovern.
So you're a recent...
You know, I voted for all those guys. Well, I voted for Democrats all along.
Well, maybe it's not too late. It's not too late to bring you back from the brink, Ann. Maybe salvation is still possible for you. Maybe this was just a weird flirtation with right-wing loonies.
It was a little... it was something weird. It was a little weird thing called 9/11.
That was it.
Yeah, that the Democrat... I considered voting for Kerry, but I felt that he never really established his national security credentials. So it was all about national security.
Well, Kerry...
That's why I hate to see Lieberman lose, because he tried to be a national security Democrat, and I feel bad that the liberal hawk is a thing of the past, or if you're a liberal hawk, you get kicked out of the party. But I don't think Lieberman was the greatest example of someone who was being inspiring as a liberal hawk. I just want some liberal hawks like in the old days. I've voted for Democrats all along. I've always been registered as a Democrat.
Yeah, we hadn't planned to talk about this, but I definitely can't stop at this point. I guess I could say... a few things. Well, one is Kerry, you know, one of the hardest votes I ever cast in my life was voting for Kerry, just because I found him extremely unattractive. I think he's completely inauthentic. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a real John Kerry. And also, I thought he was not articulating a good war on terror strategy, but I would not say he was being insufficiently hawkish. I would say it's the opposite. I would say he did not have the courage to say being hawkish is not always the answer in a war on terror. Sometimes it's the problem. My own view is that since that election, my view has been vindicated. You know, our most hawkish single act, the war in Iraq, has, by the lights of almost everyone, made the terrorism situation probably worse. The Israel's recent hawkish behavior, very robust response to retaliation, has, by the lights of most people I read, made Israel less secure as a nation, America less secure as a nation.
Well, you don't get to see the alternative. You can say, well, I'm not happy with the way things are going, but you don't get to roll back and see if you'd have done the other thing, what would have happened. And by the time 2004 came around, the war in Iraq had already started. So it wasn't a question of, well, should we do this or not? It was, what should we do now that we're already here? And what frustrated me the most was I didn't want to hear talk about how you would have done something different in the past. I always wanted to hear what you were going to do in the future. And I just think Kerry never said anything satisfying.
Well, and in Kerry's case, you're right. But I do think people who oppose the war in Iraq and predicted anything vaguely like what would happen do have right to point to the fact that they predicted this in the way of shoring up their own credentials. Right. It matters who was right and who was wrong.
Yeah, but they still have to convince me now that we're here. Are they going to be the one to get us to the next good point? Hey, you know, I should tell you that I voted for Feingold as my senator.
Whoa.
In 2004.
So you cast the one Feingold Bush ballot that was cast.
That's not true. Feingold got more votes than Kerry in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. So there were a few. There were a number. Yeah.
So, and it makes sense, too, because, you know, a senator really isn't going to do that much that has to do with national security. So you might support Feingold because you like his position on a lot of liberal issues, domestic things. But you might still not want him to be president.
Yeah.
But it made perfect sense to me. I voted for Feingold every time he's run. In fact, when he was first running, the first few times, a couple of times he ran, I gave him money. He was the first candidate I ever gave money to, by the way.
Well, my great concern about the future of the world, well, one among them, is the fact that what I think is actually sometimes the smartest thing to do in response to terrorist provocation, which is forbearance, is very hard to counsel, because the most natural thing, the most natural human thing to do is what the Israelis did in response to Hezbollah. And it's very hard to endure ongoing terrorist provocation with either limited retaliation or even no retaliation. But I really think if you do the thought experiment, if you ask what kind of shape would Israel be in if they had done like a day's worth of retaliation and since then just endured any missiles and said, okay, look, these guys, this is at this point, there's no excuse for what they're doing. We're not even fighting them. I think Israel as a nation would be more secure than they are. But that's it's very hard to convince people of that. And I admit that rhetorically, it's hard to make that a winning strategy. But that's one reason I am greatly concerned about the future.
Yeah, well, I'm upset about the Lebanon situation, too. I mean, it seems to me if you're going to start to fight, you should do it in some brilliantly successful way and not give people any room to say that you're doing it badly. And once you start making mistakes, it makes the whole idea of fighting seem like a mistake.
Yeah, well, it's been a real blow because Israel had this mystique. Their military success had given them this aura of invincibility, but in retrospect, you know, those military successes had come against nation states. It's a very different kind of thing from fighting a terrorist organization, which can in effect win by killing two or three Israelis a week. What they had done before was fend off ambitions to actually take over Israel by force. You know, a nation state wants to take over your country. Well, Hezbollah has no illusions that they're going to be able to take over Israel anytime soon, and they're not in that sense an existential threat, at least now. But now, by kind of, I think, ill-advisedly putting all of their military credibility on the line, you know, the Israelis have sacrificed one of the greatest assets they had, which is that these guys are tough and they know the neighborhood, you know.
And yet you can't allow it to stand that by using terrorist techniques, you can always get away with it, because there's no way to fight terrorism. I mean, if the message gets out that terrorism, it actually works, you can bring anyone down with terrorism. That would be a terrible
thing. But can you imagine positive reinforcement any greater than what Hezbollah has received, at least as of now, as we speak? The stature of their leader is way higher than it's ever been in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. This is reward wilder than I think he imagined. So, so if you're saying it's bad to let terrorists lob missiles into your country for a week and not do anything or do little, I have to say, compared to what? You know, sometimes forbearance.
I'm not going to disagree with that. I think if you're going to start to fight, you better have a way to do it that works well. And I don't know why they do it. I can't explain that.
Well, we initially planned not to talk about geopolitics, and I actually didn't try to lure you into it, I swear.
Yeah, you pulled me.
Not true. I will review the videotape and let viewers decide who is responsible for this. But in any event, this has been a lot of fun, and we'll have to get you on again in the near future, if you're game. Even if you can't get Kevin Barrett to come on with you, although that is our ideal. Great TV, Anne.
I like to talk to a reasonable person.
But that, you know, they have this saying, you know, when something goes viral on the internet, you know, that could go viral. You and Kevin Barrett. Just think about it. Think about it.
But, you know, but the thing is, I won't talk about the engineering problem. I mean, if someone starts barraging me with scientific theories, I'm not qualified to do that.
I see. That could be a problem.
I mean, the whole thing of being a conspiracy theorist is that you're willing to fling... I mean, I'm willing to fling myself into talking about a lot of things, like geopolitics, but I'm not going to start talking about at what heat steel melts and whether steel bends but doesn't melt. All of that stuff. I can't talk about
that. I see the problem. Okay. We'll have Mickey and him then. I guess we'll let you talk to somebody else. Although if you do get Kevin, we will double what we're paying you, Ann. Okay?
Oh, no.
Can you do that math
your
head?
Yeah, I did that math
okay.
in my head. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. And
thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.